That text, a text from Job that you heard read, always takes me back to Connie LaRosse. When I visited Connie in the hospital, she was dying of cancer, and they'd have one thing happen after another, and we had a really nice visit. And then I said, I'm going to read scripture for you, and she said, you might want to read from the book of Job. It was a cry, but also a word of faith as well. Thanks for being here this morning. Really good to be together. Thank you for coming out. We trust God to meet us here in this place with a word for us as we try to live our life out there in community and in our families. Now, the question that we're going to consider this morning is among the oldest questions of all the stargazers and nomads and theological thinkers who have gone before us. The question that we will consider this morning is common to all people in all creeds in all periods of human history. And it is a painful question to even consider. But we're going to do just that this morning. Now, our text this morning comes from the Gospel of Mark, the fourth chapter. It is early in Jesus' ministry. He has been baptized. He has moved from Nazareth to Capernaum, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee now. He has called his disciples to follow him, and they have followed. Jesus has been teaching and healing. He is attracting large crowds. The Jesus movement is just taking flight. People are traveling to see him now. They are walking many miles to hear words of grace, to be given some glimmer of hope in a first century world that was very harsh and very unforgiving. People were traveling to see this country preacher and miracle worker, hoping to have demons exorcised or withered hands restored or sick children cured. Now, it was clear to most of the common people that Caesar, back there in Rome, did not really care about them, and the occupation forces of the Roman Empire did not care about them. The tax collectors, you guessed it, did not care about them. No one really expected occupying forces and politicians and government officials to care about the common people, but there was some hope that the religious people would care, and there were certainly some religious people who did care, but that was the exception, not the rule. It was clear to most of the common people that the religious leaders in Jerusalem did not care about them. They cared more about outward appearances than they did about the day-to-day life of the common people. And they used religious laws to oppress the poor and the sick and the unclean. The Jesus movement seemed different, though. This rabbi was different from any other that they had ever met or heard. Children were welcomed by Jesus. Sinners were given words of hope. And Jesus proclaimed the forgiveness of sin. Jesus preached of new beginnings, of starting over, and his teachings ran totally counter to the conventional wisdom of the rabbis. The basic religious teaching was simple. You get what you deserve. God is watching your every move and taking note, and God rewards you or God punishes you accordingly. Now, they knew that it was impossible for the rabbis to know what people were doing in dark places, behind closed doors, in their business practices, or in their marriages. But God knows. God knows, and God is the judge, the jury, and the executioner. If you are poor, it is not an accident. It's a punishment. It is your lot in life. You've been cursed by your sin or the sin of your parents. And if you are less than healthy, it's not by accident. God knows. God is just. God hands out hidden sentences as a punishment for bad behavior. If you are sick or grief-stricken or hungry, you must be getting what you deserve. And conversely, if you are healthy and wealthy and wise, then that's because God wants you to be healthy, wealthy, and wise. It's a reward. You have earned it. Consequently, those who were blessed were very self-righteous, puffed up about it. But the common people, those who struggled paycheck to paycheck, those who had to rely on the charity of others, those who found little reason to have hope in this world, for those common people, it seemed to them that no one really cared about them. No one cared except maybe a few family members and others who found themselves in the same cursed station in life. You know, misery loves company. Then along came the rabbi from the Galilee. Along came Jesus, and he said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for you will be welcomed into the kingdom of heaven." Blessed, not cursed. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who hungry. Blessed are those who thirst. Blessed are those who are oppressed and persecuted, lost and rejected. You see, this was a word of good news from Jesus in a harsh world that was largely devoid of good news. And Jesus not only spoke these words, he followed up the good words with good action. He healed lepers. He fed the teeming masses. He listened. He touched. He offered forgiveness. And he offered hope. Someone cared. And those are sweet words to be heard when you think that no one cares. Well, all of this is just a little background information as we're about to encounter our assigned text for this morning from the fourth chapter of the Gospel of Mark. It had been a busy day for Jesus and the disciples along the shores of the Sea of Galilee. As the sun beat down, large crowds had pressed in on Jesus, and he had given his all. He taught with parables, stories that could be remembered, truths that still inform our lives even today. He had given his all, and he was exhausted now. It was late in the day. I'm not sure what their plans were for the evening, but Jesus was exhausted. He needed some space. So he said to his disciples, "Let us go across to the other side of the Sea of Galilee." The text says they departed, and it implies that they did so without much preparation. It says that Jesus left just as he was. What does that mean? It means no water shoes, no rain jacket, no Dramamine, no life jacket, no overnight bag. They just got in the boat as they were. It was late, they were tired, and they set out on the sea. Now, this journey was one that the fishermen had made 1,000 times before, though it would have been very rare indeed to make this journey in the darkness of night. It was an 8-mile journey across the lake in a small wooden boat. Now, for perspective, the Mukilteo-Clinton ferry crossing is 3.5 miles. Now, I was on the ferry last Monday night. The sun was going down. The water was just like glass. What a peaceful, beautiful crossing it was. We had taken Felicia's father to Ivor's for dinner. And if you've been to Ivor's now, on the wall in Ivor's, there are photographs showing the sometimes violent waters of the Puget Sound tossing ferry boats around like toys. Have you been on a crossing like this? Oh, yeah. Lots of heads nodding. You know, in October of 2003, a fierce windstorm blew into Mukilteo, and the restaurant was mostly destroyed that night. And I was there that night. I was not at Ivor's in the restaurant. No, I was stuck in a ferry line that would not move. Just coming home from Minnesota, it would not move because it was too dangerous to load the ferries. Now, last Monday night, as I looked out on that glassy water, I commented to Felicia that it was hard to imagine that it was the same crossing and the same water. It's 8 miles across the Sea of Galilee. Jesus and his disciples got in the boat as they were unprepared for a storm. They began to cross. They were perhaps halfway there when a great windstorm arose, and suddenly and frighteningly, great waves were battering their little boat. And it was clear to these fishermen that they were in trouble. Their very lives were in danger. You see, they had spent their lives on the lake. They made their living there. The sea was a part of the rhythm of their lives. But they had also lost friends and relatives here. You see, boats capsized, boats broke up, people drowned each and every year on the Sea of Galilee. The fishermen knew that the life-giving, sweet water of the sea had a darker, more dangerous side. And now they were out on this water at night, caught in a violent storm, unprepared, terrified, not knowing if they would ever make it to the shore again, not knowing if they would ever see their wives and children again. And what about Jesus? Jesus was exhausted, spent, very human. He was sleeping. A wave came up over the side of the boat. The boat was about to be swamped. The disciples woke Jesus up and they asked the eternal question, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Jesus then called out to the wind and the waves, and the great storm ceased. And there was, the text tells us, a dead calm. And Jesus looked at his disciples and said, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe, and they said to one another, "Who is this? Who is this then that even the wind and the sea obey him?" This is our text. This is the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, as we look at this incredible text, there are three questions in this story which stand out to me. Let's begin with Jesus, because it's always good to begin with Jesus. Jesus said to his disciples, "Why are you afraid?" Let's be clear, the disciples were afraid. And they were afraid for good reason, I would maintain. That is, if death by drowning is a fearful thing to you, I would be afraid. Let me be very clear that if I am out on the ocean, the smallest boat I ever want to be on should say Holland America on the side of it. I would be filled with fear. But then a little fear is a good thing, is it not? A little fear in life can, in fact, save our life. It's a good thing to be a little afraid when driving a car or crossing a busy street on foot or before saying, "I do." A little fear can keep us alive or out of jail. Having said that, most of the things that we spend our time worrying about are either out of our control or they're really not a threat to us at all. Thanks to our overactive imaginations and the 24-hour news cycle, we spend far too much time and far too much energy worrying, time and energy that would be better spent by simply caring for our families or writing cards to shut-ins or singing in the choir with Carl. If you made a list of all the things that you're currently afraid of, most of those things, I guarantee you, will be inconsequential as you look back 5 or 10 years from now. Irrational fear, misplaced fear. We spend too much time being afraid. Fear can keep us alive, but fear can also keep us from living. The second question from Jesus to his disciples is this: have you still no faith? Now, they were caught in a storm. Life is filled with storms. Literal storms like the great windstorm of 2003 and non-weather related storms that blow into our lives and blow into our families every now and then. I am guessing that there are many of us here this morning who are currently in the midst of a relationship storm. You see, it's not easy being human, and it's never easy living with other humans. Husbands and wives who desperately are trying to remember why they even got married to begin with. Parents and children who are caught up in power struggles in their home. Battles within families over inheritances. Politics at work or politics in general. Neighbors who don't get along. As sure as there are seasons in the year, there will be storms in our life. I know there are many here today who battle against the great storms of addiction or depression. Many don't know how they're going to pay the bills next month, and many wonder if the sermon's ever going to end. The disciples found themselves in the midst of a violent storm. They bobbed around like a cork in the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus responds by calming the storm. And when it was dead quiet, he said, "Have you still no faith?" Let me translate that for you. Is your faith in God dependent upon the weather? Because I'm here to tell you that you should expect storms. You should expect to be lied to and betrayed in your life. Do not think that you'll be the first human in human history to go through life unscathed without bruises or blemishes or disability. You see, the weather changes. It's all there in the Bible. Look at the book of Ecclesiastes. For everything there's a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, you should expect that. A time to die, expect that one too. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. And that's it, in a nutshell, the human experience. So if you are weeping right now, know that you will someday dance again. And if you are laughing right now, you better hold on, because somewhere down the line, you're going to be weeping. The weather changes. No season lasts forever. This is the human experience, and no one escapes it. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. No one gets to escape the valley of the shadow of death. No one. No one escapes the storms of life. And this is not a sign that God is angry with you. This is not a sign that God is punishing you or no longer present in your lives. It's simply a mark of your own humanity shared with the rest of us in this room. But if your faith is so shaky that a change in the weather threatens your faith, then you have very little faith. The disciples were in the valley of the shadow of death. They were in trouble, but Jesus was with them. They were not alone. And now comes the painful question, the question posed by those closest to Jesus, the question that all honest people have sometimes asked, someday or maybe every day of their lives. And here's the question: Rabbi, do you not care that we are perishing? Teacher, do you not care? Lord, do you not care? God, are you up there? And if you're up there, do you not care? Your children are in slavery in Egypt. Do you not care? Job had lost his wife, his children, his home, his riches. He'd lost his health. His friends now seemed more like tormentors to him. And Job confronts God by saying, Lord, do you not care about my plight? We all find ourselves in this place asking the question, does God really care about me? Does God care that I'm living in great fear and uncertainty right now? Does God care that my husband has dementia? Does God care about the chronic pain that makes my life miserable every day? It is a painful question to ask because we know that ultimately we have nowhere else to turn but to God. Ultimately, our only hope is in God. It's a painful question to ask because we have bet our lives on Jesus. Lord, do you not care that we're perishing? Job called out, Lord, I've lost everything. Do you not care? And how did God answer Job? God said, Job, can you remind me, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have such great understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know, Job. On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid the cornerstone? Job, did you create yourself? Or was it me who gave you life? Job, you must expect the storms of life. The weather on planet Earth is always changing. Into each life, a little or a lot of rain will fall. And if the sun's out, Job, then there's going to be storm clouds on the horizon. And if you're laughing now, Job, and dancing, then soon you're going to be crying and mourning. You're going to be standing at graveside, or you're going to be looking up from your own casket. You must not think, you see, we must not think that following Jesus is some kind of an insurance policy. An insurance policy for us against calamity or peril or disease or death. You do remember the followers of Jesus, don't you? How did it turn out for them? The followers of Jesus all died, and most of them died grisly deaths as martyrs for the faith. You see, there's no heavenly insurance policy. God cannot protect us from life, just as God cannot protect our children and grandchildren from the natural perils of life. Lord, do you not care that we are perishing? The question is as old as time. It is the cry of human toddlers trying to understand their world and railing against pain and loss. The question is as old as time, and it's a painful question for people of faith to ask. Psalm 34 sums it up pretty well. Psalm 34 says, "The Lord is near the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord rescues them from them all. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in the Lord will be condemned." Yes, the righteous, you see, are afflicted. The Lord is near the brokenhearted. But God is not angry, and God is not absent. But God cannot protect us from life, from living, from loving, and losing love, from being human. And so in the midst of the inevitable storms of this life, we look around, we know God is with us, and that's the gospel of the Lord.